welcome to How to Medieval, the how-to where two guys show you how to do it between the two of them. My name is Ari.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're going to be highlighting some of our favorite books when it regards the medieval aesthetic and genre. And so these are going to be kind of off the top of our heads, books that we think of, books that we like, and they're going to be from the gamut of tertiary sources to fiction books that are set in the medieval era. And that's going to be nice, light, fun. What is it that we like to read? What is it that you might like to read if you have a couple moments to go through some pages?
And especially so, because a lot of newcomers get really inspired by books that they've read about what they want their kit to be, what they want their backstory to be something like. So making sure that we're offering up some of the books that we like may help you figure out what you want to do in this crazy hobby.
And that's true. And that's apart from trying necessarily to inform a specific impression, that can also be just a sort of interest in the medieval-ishness in general. And so I like to think about how, I've said multiple times, like, what's gotten me into this hobby? What got me interested in the medieval era? And a lot of it comes from arguably non-medieval sources in that I really liked Lord of the Rings, amongst other things, but just for the purpose of example, we'll pull that one out. And the Lord of the Rings books are, they're sword and sorcery, they're fantasy, but they've got this medieval-ishness to it. That coupled with D&D, this medieval-ishness to it, there's no authenticity expectations. There's no, a lot of them aren't even set in Earth. That's a different world, different cultures. There's mystical creatures, there's magic, but it's all got this medieval vibe, right? And that sort of kindled an interest in the medieval, the medieval aesthetic in general, not the medieval aesthetic from a point of view of getting things to look accurately medieval, but just the genre of medieval play. And so a book can inspire not just specifics, but just the very interest in reenacting in the first place. How do people sort of stumble on this hobby? Well, a lot of them come from arguably non-medieval places, like reading things like Lord of the Rings.
I think Lord of the Rings is probably one of those baseline. You're going to be hard-pressed to find somebody who's into medievalism who hasn't read or been into Lord of the Rings.
Right.
It's pervasive. And one could argue that Tolkien really started that popular medievalist idea through the fiction of the Lord of the Rings and bringing it out, because he himself was a medievalist and linguist and studied medieval languages in order to shape some of his worlds and studied medieval stories to shape some of his worlds and the influence as well. And you can see the influence that he from those stories that he studied in things like the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit.
I definitely get that sense about it, and I also like how we kind of. I don't want to call George R. R. Martin like our generation's Tolkien, because I feel like at some point that's enough to get me like a fire and pitchfork mob coming at me. But the point is, realistically, there are people who have never read Tolkien, kind of understand what Lord of the Rings is from the movies, but they have legitimately read the Game of Thrones books or seen the Game of Thrones show and then went and tried to read the books afterwards. Who cares what direction you get to get there? But I mean, we see people who come to Ren Fairs, people who come to medieval timeline events, people who, find Facebook groups on medieval stuff because they liked Game of Thrones. And so there's a lot of legitimate ways to get to the hobby that aren't necessarily through Tolkien, even if I suppose Tolkien is OG and has that pedestal that he well deserves to stand on.
Tolkien is the OG. I like it.
Yeah, medieval fantasy OG, man.
Medieval fantasy OG. You can definitely, in George R. R. Martin's work, you can definitely see the influence that someone like Tolkien definitely had over him. I don't know if I would call him this generation's Tolkien. Maybe if you combine him and Robert Jordan.
See, he was definitely going to be my follow-up. But the problem with Robert Jordan is, except for the fact that there's a new series out, and I have no idea how good it is, Robert Jordan, all those Wheel of Time books, as much as I love them, have read most of them twice, not all of them. I've read all 13 at least once, and I've read a lot of the first books, like Eye of the World, a couple times. is that it's mostly medieval fantasy dorks that know his work. I don't feel he has the same level of almost pop culture acclaim that maybe Tolkien and Martin both have.
I think Tolkien have, because like you said, he's the OG. I think that's where his acclaim came from. He's the one that really kicked all this stuff off. Martin, did people really know Game of Thrones before HBO picked it up and started making the series? Was it really that well? I mean, I guess it had to be for HBO to want to pick it up.
I don't think it was, to be fair, because I had read the first book because, like, it was just a fantasy medieval book that was on a stack of that particular genre, and I enjoyed it, but I never read the rest of them until it became really popular, and then I wanted to read the books before that particular series addressed that particular book. But that's exactly why I think that Martin has this hold on the community zeitgeist that Jordan doesn't, even if his books are better, and that's because of television. And I think that there was a time when Tolkien was not...
Because of the naughty bits.
Yeah, well, I mean, sex sells, right?
It does.
And so it's those... I think it was the Lord of the... How many... it's arguable that how many people knew who Tolkien was outside of the D&D crowd before they made those movies, right? Maybe as many, maybe a little more, because he'd been around longer and there'd been a whole generation to appreciate his books, and and whereas Martin was kind of a contemporary author. But I think that there is a lot to be said for the Hollywood portrayal of a good Hollywood portrayal of these books, pushing what is otherwise a niche author and work into a more popular forum when it comes to reading.
And to sort of to derail for just a second here, a lot of that, I think, you have to give credit to the Marvel universe, because I remember growing up where if you like superheroes, if you like Lord of the Rings, you know, you were a nerd, you were a dork. And now because of, you know, the popularity of the Marvel universe and what they've built, it's cool to like superheroes now. It's cool to like Lord of the Rings. So it's really the geek have inherited the earth, I guess you can say.
I like the way that goes. I can live with that. So here, continuing to diverge from the topic, but this is about fun and interest, so we'll let this episode go where it goes. But we were at my daughter's bridging ceremony from Brownie to Juniors for Girl Scouts. And so one of the treats they gave them, obviously, they gave them all junior mints because they became juniors, and the couple daisies that became brownies, they got little cosmic brownies. It makes sense. But everyone got a box of Nerds because some kids might not like mints, and so they gave them a candy they wanted to eat. And then, you know, we the parents will eat the boring minty ones, right? And but I noticed that the Nerds were branded Dungeons and Dragons. They had Dungeons and Dragons, like the WotC Dungeons and Dragons, old, like almost the 80s stylized. They were Dungeons and Dragons Nerds. All the little Nerds on the packaging were dressed up like little clerics and fighters and barbarians and wizards. And it was a D&D themed Nerds box. And I remember looking at the first thing I said was, I remember getting picked on at 13 years old for liking Dungeons and Dragons. And here they are just on the box of Nerds because it's cool for everybody.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, you Googled it.
They've got like a mimic treasure chest with its mouth full of Nerds.
So speaking of that, you go on TikTok again. You go on TikTok and you see like a there's this like video of this like woman. She's like laying on a couch and she slides into like inside the folds of the couch. I'm not sure what the intent of the original video was, but what showed up on my feed was not that original video, but was someone stitching it. And so as soon as she got sucked into the couch, it jumped to, and this is what we call a mimic. And like, how is everyone knows what this means now? There was a time when you said, she got eaten by a mimic. People would look like you got a third eye in your head.
You know? If you buy the big box that has a bunch of the smaller boxes in it, it's drunk Dungeons and Dragons Nerds game. You can redeem. You can buy any participating Nerds product by March 31st, 2022. Snap a photo of your receipt with a qualifying purchase to an upload to nerdcandy.com D&D by March 31st, 2022. And you get six mini modules of D&D.
Yeah, and
You get D&D games from them.
Yeah, the modules, you can go through all the modules, and it's like becomes like a full adventure if you get them all.
Folks, yeah. I do not. The world has changed. I feel like.
Like you're in the Twilight Zone?
Yeah, I feel like some old man that was just like, you know, I used to be like, oh, in my day, nerd, you didn't want to do that. It's like, and now it's like, oh, hey, this candy company, everybody's playing D&D now. It's like, what happened? What? Yeah. I mean, it's great, don't get me wrong, but I'm just like, how did that happen? What changed in the world?
Stranger Things.
Yeah, I think you're right. These very popular TV shows and movies became. My wife is just staring at me like I'm crazy. But I think you're right. Like these very popular TV shows and movies show people playing these games or reading these books. And suddenly it's like, well, if they're doing it, it must be cool. So I guess it's okay to do this now.
Yeah. And whether or not it had value to start with, TV can make things cool. And I think that's why Game of Thrones has this hold on the public opinion that Jordan doesn't, even though he deserves it. And I can only hope that the TV show does justice to Wheel of Time, because I think Wheel of Time is objectively better. It's granted, it's arguably different, but I like it better because because Wheel of Time feels much more like D&D, being honest, it feels more like D&D, and it's hard to have D&D written well. Like, there's literal books written about, like, D&D by the D&D, like, by WotC published novels that aren't very good. The Salvatore books are kind of, they're all right. And then you've got the Dragonlance books, which the problem with Dragonlance is it's the same problem with the Star Wars EU, was that, you know, you have a half a dozen different authors, 30 different authors, each one may or may not be any good. So a lot of them are great and some of them aren't. But you have a lot of these books that try to effectively key in on D&D culture in novelization form. And I feel the Wheel of Time's books did that better than really any other book. Sanderson can do it a little bit. He's probably the next best at it.
I like playing D&D. I don't think I've ever read an actual D&D book. That's not true. We have in this house an old, like, 1980-something choose-your-own-adventure book that is a Dungeons & Dragons adventure.
Yeah. Yeah. Those can be cool, especially at their intended audience.
Yeah, exactly. It's for kids, but it's really funny. It's fun to read and do things. But yeah, I don't think I've ever actually read any of the novels. And I'll be perfectly honest, I never finished the Wheel of Time series.
I mean, it's long. I'll give you that. It's an investment.
My defense, Robert Jordan never finished the Wheel of Time series either.
Well, I mean, we haven't died yet, so we don't have as good an excuse.
That's true. Okay, fine. I'll get back to reading.
It's good. It does go a little squirrely. Like, there's a point, I think, in the eighth book where I kind of really, even having, I think that's probably where I stopped rereading the series the second time. I think the first six are my favorite. By seven or eight, like, I kind of really lose track of what's going on. And I can't remember. I think the 10th book comes back really strong, but I'd have to go back and look at the titles to remember which one's which. But I can understand why some people don't finish it. But the first six are like dynamite. I love those books so much.
Now, some books that I love, if you're like me and you like sort of medieval fantasy based in reality, I really like basically anything done by Bernard Cornwell. Give me any book by Bernard Cornwell and I will sit down and absolutely love it. I absolutely love his three book Arthurian Grail series. That one, it's like The Winter King, Enemy of God, and Excalibur are the three books of that series. I love those books. They do an excellent job of, I really sort of love how it never really says whether or not magic is real, but the people of the time believed the magic is real, and that's how it comes through. I really like his Harlequin series that focuses around the Hundred Years' War.
I read his Azincourt book a long, long time ago. I've never read any of his serials, though.
I love Azincourt was a good book. There's a follow-up to that. It's like, no, I'm sorry. It's a follow-up to the Harlequin book. That's the it's like 1386 or something like that. It's one of his books. Again, another excellent book. He does a really good job of, he gets details right about things that happen, but he doesn't like follow main characters of the time. He has his own characters that he interjects into the time that are sort of swept up into these events, and we're sort of getting to see these events from somebody who was there, but it's not like a super important or historical figure. So, you know, you're not looking at it going, well, that's not right. You know, Charles de Bourbon never said that, you know, it's like, so it's, I really like how he does that. And then of course he's got his own, the whole Sharps, serial.
See, I've only ever watched the Sharps. I've read, so as far as I understand, the Sharp novels were the mulleted, cool guy, redneck answer to the, what do you call it, the Hornblower series, which was all about Napoleonic maritime, like the naval service. And the Hornblower books were arguably very cerebral because the main character was like an incredibly cerebral type character. And Forrester kind of created this interest in the Napoleonic era. And then, as far as I understand, without trying to denigrate the books, that the Sharp novels were written to be, the main character, Sharp, in those books, was meant to be a sort of a contrast to Hornblower, where he was much more of a man's man. He was rough around the edges. He was, you know, gruff, and he was smart enough to survive, but he wasn't like this cerebral kind of in his head kind of guy. And he was kind of like a macho answer to the Hornblower series. And then, Sean Bean played him, and he did a very good job at it.
I was gonna say, isn't the Sharp series the only series where Sean Bean doesn't die?
Yes, I believe that's true, because he dies in that Black Death movie, he dies in Lord of the Rings, he dies in Mission Impossible, right? That one James Bond movie where he plays 006, and then I'm sort of running out of movies I remember him in, but. Yes, I think he does. Well, okay, so here's the thing. The Sharp series ends with him marching into Waterloo, and obviously, like, it doesn't end with him dying, but it also, like, we know the battle didn't go very well, and, like, most people died, and, like, so he could have survived, and I think there was, like, another movie later, but the movie wasn't based on any of the books, but at this point, I'm just kind of, like, winging it on what I know about those books.
Apparently, actually, there's 7 movies where Sean Bean doesn't die.
Oh my goodness.
So I guess we'll have to track those down. I've seen a couple of them. I forgot. Well, a lot of these it's like National Treasure. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot he was in National Treasure.
Was he? It's been so long since I watched that movie.
Well, good for him.
That's sort of National Treasure. It's not a book, but it's sort of that same historical vein.
It is in the historical vein. But you know what? Think about from in the historical vein and in the medieval era, and you were talking about Bernard Cornwell. That always reminds me of the Christian Cameron books, especially the one that I've read, The Ill-Made Knight. It was actually a gift that was sent to me from one of the people who likes the Turnpaterra Project, and it's a fantastic book. Like, it's really good. It suffers from, I think, the same problem that, like, a lot of genre books do. Like, you know, you read post-apocalyptic fiction or you read, like, military fiction, and there's some points at which the narration belabors how much the author knows about how certain very small particular niche things work. There's a lot of that in this book. Like, there's a lot of, like, okay, we get it. You really know 14th century Armitage Azari. But You know how arming swords and armor and stuff, like, there's a lot of really crunchy details that I think make people who are like, who enjoy a little more lighter medieval fare kind of zone out. But otherwise, I think that would be my only, that and the fact that it's told in sort of semi third person, but also sort of first person, in that the whole book is the main character telling the story about the main character. And those are my only two critiques. Otherwise, I love that book and I'll read it again.
So, I mean, Christian actually is a reenactor in his own right.
Yes, he is. He does a lot of Roman stuff too, right?
He does a lot of Greek stuff. Roman too, but Greek. But that's one of the reasons why he gets a lot of those details right, because he's done it. He's lived it. He's tried it. So he also publishes under the name Miles Cameron. So he has two. He has the Traitor's Son cycle, which is the Red Knight, the Fell Sword, the Dread Worm, the Plague of Swords, Fall of Dragons, the Messenger's Tale. The Messenger's Tale 2, and he also has a series called Masters and Mages under that name of Miles Cameron, which there's three books in that too. So he's really prolific. He's written a lot of books.
That's awesome. Some of those things you just mentioned, the titles sound vaguely familiar, so it's possible I have read some of his other work not realizing it was him.
Yeah, he's another great one. I need to read more. My problem is lately, I was telling Ari before we started taping the show today, folks, is that I don't read a lot of fiction books anymore. You know, I'm constantly reading because it's what I have to do for work, but it's all nonfiction. It's all, source material, tertiary sources, things like that. So I'm constantly reading things, but I never really, hardly ever sit down to really look at a fiction book anymore. And I need to start doing that again, because I miss reading fiction books. I really like getting into those worlds and living in them for a little while.
Well, what I find funny is we were talking about how much fiction do we actually get around to reading now in our 30s and such. And I found that I'm thinking through all my head, like, okay, so what are some medieval themed books that I like really remember? And a lot of them are like kids and young adults books, because my daughter has been getting into, she's 10, turning 11 in summer. So she's really getting into fiction books, and she's getting into the point where she can read her own in addition to me reading chapter books aloud to her. But a lot of the things that I've read in the last, 3-4 years have been kids, and pretty much aimed at little girls and little boys. And they're actually, most of them are really good. And it's something to think about when we want to kindle the love for what we do. That sometimes you drag the kids along and they're like, why do we want to tear ourselves away from our cell phones to eat at burnt food at a campfire in the cold? And, maybe if we were able to kindle this like headspace, this medieval headspace, even if it starts in fantasy, there's a lot of really good children's literature out there. And the couple that we've been really into, a long time ago, I tried to read her Redwall, because I love Redwall, and it's medievally, they're little mice, they use swords, and it's effectively everything that I liked about The Secret of Nim, but in a book. And so I liked Redwall a lot. I tried to read that to her.
Hold on, did you just said it's everything you liked about The Secret of Nim, but in a book?
Yeah, well, yeah, because when I was a kid, before I realized that it was a book, it was a movie. And I found Redwall before I found the actual novel of the movie of Secret of Nim.
Okay, good. I'm glad you just, because
I'm aware that it's a book, but in my journey for the longest time, it was just a movie.
It's a book. There's more than one Nim book. Anyway, it's just that. I'm sorry. I was just going I was like, Ari, have a conversation.
Can we sidebar, please? No, but when I was a kid, I would read Redwall because I didn't, it was like I said, it was everything that the Secret of Nim gave me in my headspace, but on page, and I loved reading. But she didn't like it. She didn't get it. It was a little too much for her when I started reading it to her. So I read first thing I think I read to her that was clearly medieval fantasy was The Secret Rescuers, The Storm Dragon. It's a book by Paula Harrison. It's a quick little book, and it's about this, you know, medievalish girl. She lives in a castle, and she finds a baby storm dragon, and, you know, child level drama ensues. And so that was a really fun book, and that has led me to, she reads a lot of The Wide Awake Princess by Edie Baker, and they are, you know, a medieval princess in kind of clearly Disney-esque magical world. In fact, they interact with like Snow White, and they interact with all these different fairy tale personalities as she goes through this 7 series books. And I think these two books have gotten my daughter more interested in Turnip of Terror stuff and medieval stuff than anything else that we have done, including like physically going to events. They just, those are the two books that have kindled in her, I feel, the interest in the medieval aesthetic and the kind of the culture of playing medieval. That, and on top of the Harry Potter and the Lord of the Rings movies, I've read the Harry Potter books aloud to her, and I've read some of The Hobbit aloud to her, but Tolkien's a little bit much for her at the moment. We'll circle back to the books. But those I think, are the, those are the spine of her interest in medieval stuff right now.
He read The Hobbit to Max when Amanda was pregnant with him. So that was a lot of fun. I don't know if it has informed anything, but we tried. It's funny the thing, you know, I don't really read fiction because my house is literally packed wall to wall with medievalish fantasy fiction books. My wife is an avid reader. She reads 2 to 3 books at a time. She'll have her downstairs book, she'll have her upstairs book, and then she'll have her bedtime book. So it's like,
I know how that feels. You've got your book in your car, your book in your office, your book in the bedroom, book downstairs, book at the table. Yeah, I got that.
Exactly. And but we literally, we have, I'm sitting in the room we call our library right now, and we have one, probably 8 by 6 foot tall bookshelf that's packed. We've got another 8 by 5 foot bookshelf that's packed. Then we have a 6 by 8 foot bookshelf packed. It's just, and it's packed. Every single room in our house has books in it. Upstairs in our upstairs hallway, I bought 2 bookcases from a bookstore going out of business, and these are 8 foot tall by 10 feet long bookshelves, and they're packed full of books. Literally, we have 5 thousands of books, and most of them are medievalish, sort of older young adult fantasy fiction. She's one, and so I have all these series at my fingertips. Like we have the entire, well, not the entire, I don't think we have the last one, but we have the entire Wheel of Time books here. We have all the Game of Thrones books here. We have and all sorts of things. There's authors I've never even heard of. I'm looking at it now. It's like one of them is Jani Wirtz has a series, Terry Goodkind. We have all his books. It's literally almost any popular fantasy fiction author that's out there, I could reach out and just grab a book and start reading it. And so I really do need to start doing that again, I guess.
I was pointedly going to try not to recommend Terry or bring up Terry Goodkind's books, mostly because they have far too much BDSM content for my comfort level.
They have far too much what content?
You can Google that one.
Okay.
They have some strong fetish overtones that I just cannot.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, that's a little much for me.
I've never read them. So.
Like, I think one of my favorite wizard characters is Zed Zulzarander, but I find the books and, like, the entire Mord Sith, like, 500 pages of that storyline, especially in the first one, very cumbersome. I don't like it. But I do like Terry Pratchett's satirical look on all of medieval fiction, period. Like, he has probably some of the most poignant social commentary in print. The fact that he is able to so effortlessly weave every known medieval trope into some sort of gag, it's masterful.
Yeah, his any of his books, really. It's just that one particularly, because it does fit the topic very well, but any of his books are just masterpieces in my mind, because they're just all so good.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I really like them a lot. I've read, I think, almost all of Terry Pratchett's work. There's 40. I think he did 40-something books before the end. And I've read most all of them. I like them a lot. You know who else? We're thinking about really old school, like old school young adult medieval fiction, or sort of medieval-esque fiction. We've talked a lot of European history here. I wonder if you asked your wife if she's ever read The Blue Sword by Robin McKinley. That one is a fantastic, but that one's got a very like Mediterranean, Middle East feel to it, but it's clearly medieval fantasy, and it's all about, you know, a young hero discovering their abilities and things like that, which you'll find is a common theme in a lot of young adult books, because it resonates really well with a 15 to 17 year old, is, you know, coming, you know, understanding your abilities, you know, as a physical human being, and your capabilities resonates really strong with that crowd.
So she said she doesn't think she's read that one.
Oh, well, she can put it on her list. It's really good.
I'll tell her to put it on her list.
Have you read, so I know we referenced this, I believe, earlier when we were talking about television shows, but have you ever read the actual books for Pillars of the Earth, which was then turned into, like, I think an HBO or a Showtime series?
I started it and couldn't get through it.
Yeah, I've heard mixed reviews. I haven't actually had a chance to circle back around and read it, but I know that it was a fairly popular television show, which stemmed from what I thought was a well-received book series, but I've always heard sort of about half the people I've talked to really like it and half don't.
Yeah. Oh, the other, it's another Bernard Cornwell series that was turned into a TV show. Oh, what was that called? Sorry, folks. Googling. The Saxon Tales series. Huh. What is it? List of books by ever. The Last Kingdom? The Last Kingdom. That's what the name of the show.
I know that show, and I know I couldn't get through the first episode of that show, and I hope that's not a reflection on the books.
It's not a reflection on the books. The books are so much better. They were, let's see here, because it talks about, I can't believe that was 2015. Wow. Oh, wow, it's actually still going?
Is it?
They're going for a season 5? Wow.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it was based off of the Saxon stories, which is a series of novels, or the Saxon Tales, Saxon Chronicles, however you want to call it. That's how they were done in the U.S. And they're also called the Warrior Chronicles in some parts of the world. And they were, because of the show, re-released as the Last Kingdom series. But there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 books in the series. So the first one is The Last Kingdom. But no, they're really good. They're the show, I don't unless the show's gotten a lot better, because like I said, it's going for season 5 apparently. So it's on. Oh, because Netflix, maybe it's gotten better. Netflix picked it up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you know, the book series is really good. I know a lot of people who do that era reenacting who really like that book series.
Okay. That's good. Let's see. Thinking about books. You know, we should probably at least mention some period fiction, which is actually worth reading when we're talking about it. You know, we talk about the Canterbury Tales. We do an entire event based on a pilgrimage that's inspired by the Canterbury Tales. And there are some really good translations out there that make them, you know, perfectly legible to those who don't speak Middle English. In fact, I have this big illustrated abridged children's version of the Canterbury Tales that I have read through with my daughter a couple times, and it's really fun. There's actually it became popular for a reason. It's a pretty good book to read.
If you want to fully understand what society was sort of like during that time period, you need to read the Canterbury Tales, because it really is the best way to get a much richer understanding of what was going on and what society deemed as entertaining and important.
Absolutely. And I need to go, I never remember the name of it. When you're talking about what did people find funny, there's actually, what is it called? It's a book of like literal, a medieval joke book, all filled with the, of course I can't remember it because it's in Latin. My Latin is really bad, but it's Facetiae. It's an anthology of jokes by Poggio Bracciolini. And it was written in the 14th century and published in 1470. As I read from Wikipedia, and it's like it's late medieval, but the translations of these jokes, there's a lot of them. You read them and you're like, that's a whole lot of adolescent toilet humor.
Spoiler alert, folks.
So
fart
much.
Jokes are timeless.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I guess there's something to say. I guess a fart's never not funny. It's in the immortal words of Wayne from Letterkenny, fart's never not funny, but yeah, they are just love the toilet humor and the jokes. I mean, the jokes, like making fun of people, sexual infidelity and toilet humor and just, the stupid person overcoming the smart person. And it's the humor has, I mean, something we said for the humor hasn't changed all that much. And it's not like they were, I've said this before, they're not alien creatures. They were people, and a lot of what resonates with us now was clearly the same kind of thing that people resonated with in the Middle Ages.
There was that tweet that went out a few days ago. Maybe it was last week, but it was something about, I forget what the actual tweet, but it was talking about, it's like, remember, it's like there was once a guy in like the 13th century or something like that, who was given a huge bunch of land because he farted so well. So it had a link to the Wikipedia, and there really is a fully referenced and cited Wikipedia article about Roland the Farter, known in contemporary records as Roland le Farteur or Rolandus le Farteur or Roland le Petteur. He was a medieval flatulist. This was for a long time a professional farter. He lived in 12th century England. His real name was George, what they call him, but he went by, his stage name was Roland Le Farteur. He was giving Hemmingstone Manor in Suffolk, England, and 30 acres of land in return for his services as jester to King Henry II. Each year he was obliged to perform this joke called Unum Salutum et Syphiletum et Unum Bumblebulum, which roughly translates to one jump and whistle and one fart for the king's court at Christmas. This was a Christmas joke. And this cannot be true. And I'm looking, it's like, dear God, this was true. Henry II thought that this guy farting was so funny, he gave him a house and land for it. It's like, really, we really don't change. We do not change.
No, that's not at all. We're still people. For all the good and ill that is, we are still people.
To get past this one, I guess. Yes, contemporary writings of the times are great fictions. There's all the old original Arthurian ones, the Lays of Marie de France. Is just Marie de France. These are all books I had to read in college. Tristan and Isolde, the Knight of the Lion, I think it is. But these are all contemporarily written, and especially if you're those, a lot of those are really, if you're interested in the study of the early formation of chivalric ideals and courtly love ideals. Those are the ones you want to read, because those are what were being pushed in the courts, now the royal courts, not the judicial system, the royal courts, as, you know, these were the knightly ideals of the time. And you can see how they were built upon and added upon in these, as you go further and further through time. And even things like, you know, Le Morte d'Arthur, that's a medieval text too, which really was the first putting together of all of these Arthurian legends into what we sort of look at as our modern Arthurian legend. And that was, of course, done for all sorts of different reasons, not really even for entertainment, but it was, you know, the War of the Roses had been kicked off, you know, knights of the same kingdom were fighting each other, and there was this, you know, Mallory wanted to sort of instill, like, no, we shouldn't be doing this, you know, we should have this, you know, revigoration of this cult of chivalry, and that's why we're gonna put this, but we should strive to be more like Arthur and his knights of that time. So that's why, one of the reasons why that book was published and put out there. So it's interesting, mm-hmm. though, to just look at these things, and even in fiction, reading the fiction of their time, we can learn so much, because they're not just good reads.
Well, we talked about this a lot in the episode about the Green Knight, but if we're, you know, it was a lot of times we think about stories being written as novels. But if we're trying to read contemporary medieval fiction, I mean, that was written as a poem, but it's telling a story, and it is doing what we would otherwise have done in a novel today, probably, but it's doing it in rhyme. So a lot of times if you're trying to go back and read medieval literature, you're actually going to not be reading necessarily a novel structured like the way we would write a story today.
That's right. Le Morte d'Arthur reads much more, especially in modern publications, it reads much more like a novel than a poem, or than what we think of a poem, just because of sort of stylistic changings of it. But yeah, you're right. A lot of these are they're poems. Some of them even reading old Shakespeare, you can learn a lot about what maybe not so much about the events that are being retold, but what was important to the theater going society of the day. And even though, you know, Shakespeare's full of fart jokes and potty humor and innuendo too, so it's like, you're right, it's none of these humor basically peaked sometime in the 13th century or so, Roman times or something, never really went past that.
There's a lot of what you would consider low humor in the Decameron, too, which was written in the Renaissance, late medieval eras. Not so much in Inferno, though.
Well, I think it's Dante as a drag.
Just saying.
Dante's like, I wrote this book about morality.
Well, I think he came from a point of view that, you know, suffering's good for the soul, and so if you enjoyed reading his book, then you wouldn't have suffered enough to have any spiritual development.
Suffering,
that's just my take on it anyway.
Suffering is good for the soul. So if you enjoyed reading Dante, it did not fix your soul.
That's my jaded opinion on Dante's work.
I think Dante would approve, though. I think
he'd be think so too.
I think it's like you have a jaded opinion on my work. Good.
I think I think he would approve.
My work here is done. Yeah, we talked about it before briefly, but you know, basically all I read these days are history books myself. So some of the really good ones. Some of them are really good though. Especially the newer ones, you can always, if you're gonna read old history books, like academic work or biographies or something, read the old ones first, Because if you read the newer updated ones that have updated information, and then you go back and read the old ones, you're just going through the old one going, what is wrong with this guy? Why did he write? Why did he write? It's like, so I read, I do a lot of reading about Agincourt, and I do a lot of reading about, Henry V, and Ian Mortimer is a author who did a,
his name sounds familiar.
Yeah, he's a historian, an author. He also writes historical fiction, but he was a
rewrites the, what is it, the Time Traveler's Guide to
Medieval England. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
He also wrote one on Henry the Fifth. 1450, Henry's the Fifth Year of Glory. And that was from 2009. And then I read that one first, and that was great. And then I read, it's called Henry the Fifth, the Scourge of God by Desmond Seward. And the title's misleading because it makes it sound like he's like the enemy of God, but really what he was, this is something Henry the Fifth titled himself. He would be the scourge of, if France didn't basically bend to his will, he would be the scourge of God against the French and wipe them from the earth. But that was from 1988. And after reading the first, Ian Mortimer, the newer one first, and going back to the Desmond Seward one, I was like, wow, a lot of this information is just wrong. It's outdated. It's not right at all. That's why especially looking at history books done by historians, while there are some good older books out there that can give you a lot of information, a lot of background information, you got to make sure that the information isn't outdated and is correct and accurate, because like that book from 1988 had information in it that were like, well, we know the French didn't have 20,000 troops, so that's wrong, something like that. But it's still a good read. He's done some other books too. He did a lot of books about the Hundred Years' War. Ian Mortimer is really good. Anne Curry is really good.
I know you referenced her work a number of times.
Yeah. There's another one I like. What is it? I forget what it is. It's just called Agincourt, and it's by Juliet Baker. But Agincourt, Henry V and the Battle That Made England's History. It was Henry V and the Battle That Made England. That's from 2005. That was really good, too, by Juliet Barker. Anne Curry has Julie Parker has another Agincourt book out. I didn't know that. Huh. But anyway, they have so Anne Curry has 1, 2, 3, 7 books out on Agincourt. So
yeah, actually I have a copy of Ian Mortimer's book, The Time Traveler's Guide to England. I picked it up at Days of Nights, actually. I've gone about halfway through it. I enjoy it. There's things that I would disagree with just from how far what I've done so far and what I learned now, but nothing like major tear a chapter out kind of bad, just quibbles, and we'll all quibble until the day we can no longer quib. So that's really not a huge critique against the book. Otherwise I'm thoroughly enjoying the read. You know, one thing talking about Ian Mortimer's book that reminds me of, what is it? Who wrote it? I need to Google it. The Daily Life of Chaucer's England. I reread that book like every year or so, and it's a great way to kind of keep the polish on my living history ing. Geoffrey L. Singman and William McLean. It's a really good quick read, really good book, well presented information. It's not necessarily written specifically for living history folk. However, as far as I understand it, is the first real book that sprung out of the living history community, in that we have, like, we're talking about Cameron writes medieval themed books as a reenactor. So he kind of brings his reenacting to his writing. I feel, as I understand correctly, the Daily Life in Chaucer's England, it's one of those early books where it's written about history, but kind of living history folk instead of just academic historians wrote about it. And then, of course, you have your book that was written specifically by and for reenactors, which is The Peel Affinity, which is the Labette Company's book, which is a really good read. I need to get a copy of it myself. I keep meaning to go get myself a copy, though I have read through it. A couple of my friends have a copy of it, and I've thumbed through it, and it is the book on the subject of late, the 1380s, trying to reenact the late 14th, early 15th century, but not just books about medieval history. It's a handbook. I mean, I guess it's not really a handbook, but it's definitely meant for the reenactor from the reenactor.
A really fun read, and a lot of people don't know this, but Terry Jones of Monty Python fame was an avid medievalist and researcher and historian, and he's written a bunch of really good books too. One of the most recent ones that came out in 2006, I think he's written one since then, but 2006 one was called Who Murdered Chaucer? And it's a speculative, they don't even call it a fiction book because of the way it's written, but it's a work of historical speculation because we don't really know how Chaucer died. He just sort of, dead.
Bummer.
But this goes through, he went through some of Chaucer's writings and looked for evidence and sort of formed this hypothesis and did it in an entertaining and an interesting way. But yeah, it's not that expensive. It's like under $10 on Amazon if you want the paperback, but it's just really interesting. And his works, he's done a bunch of different books, and they're all really, really interesting and really well written. And a lot of people don't realize that because it's Monty Python. What? So they're like, I don't know that.
I suppose this is a tangent, but if you think about intelligent humor, like there was a lot of dumb humor, but there was a lot of like really clearly and intelligently designed humor in Monty Python's work, especially Flying Circus. They were doing a lot of, so it was very much like Terry Pratchett, doing a lot of social commentary, hiding it in humor, things like that. I mean, you can't be dumb and be that clever. So these guys clearly had a very high level of intelligence, and the fact that they had pursuits that were not just comedy were definitely a way to help write better comedy. So it does not surprise me in the slightest. In fact, I would anticipate for him to be a really amazing historian if he decided to pick up historian-ing.
So one of the other books that he wrote, which is just Terry Jones' Medieval Law, it's called Medieval Lives. That's a really good, especially to get people into it. That's a really good book by Terry Jones. So yeah, there's all sorts of good books out there.
Didn't Terry Jones do most of their animations too? Like those the cutout style, that very Monty Python-esque animation style. Didn't he do most of their actual animating?
Yeah, I think he did the actual animation on those. Yeah.
Yeah, I like Terry Jones a lot. He was an awesome guy. And I say he was, I think. Didn't he pass away just recently? I think it was like last year. I remember seeing it all over Facebook.
I don't know if it was. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the last year or the year before. But you're right. Yeah. No, actually, no. Almost a year. January 20. Almost 2 years. January of 2020 is when he passed away.
So. Yeah. Well, there you go.
It's a good thing we have some books from.
Yeah, I know. Stuff to remember him by, but. So yeah, folks, there's all sorts of good books out there.
Yeah, I'm certain the longer we sit, the more books we can come up with. But yeah, no, definitely I think what you're trying to say is that there's just so much, don't look past fiction. I think, I guess that should be the moral of this story, is don't overlook the fiction. When we get bogged down in, oh, well, the historical accuracy, the you have to, you know, we need to bathe ourselves in fact, you know, there's so much we can develop just socially and just mentally from bathing ourselves in literature.
I'm sorry. I just get this image of you like sitting in a bathtub with books. With books.
What we do on our own time.
What are you doing?
Is our own business. I like to think of, you know, the words bathing my brain, but sure, we can. I mean, it's not, I'm not the first or the last person to have a book in a bath, so.
Bathing. I like bathing my brain. That's a good one. Folks, if you also enjoy bathing your brain, go give us 5 stars on whatever you listen to us on.
Oh, yes. Please. So then, because then we can bathe your brain through your ears better than through your eyes, like with the written word.
Oh, man. This is the end of the episode, folks. You're safe now.
This is the end of me, I think.
So, yeah, this is good.
And we really, really, really need to thank Paul Butler for allowing us to use his music in front of something
For as long as he'll let us. And you can check out all of his stuff so that he can then bathe your brain in music through Paul Butler's medievalmusic.com link in the description below.
Stop saying bathing your brain.
Alternative episode title, Bathing Your Brain. Thank you, everybody. I'm glad you're listening still.
Then go and comment on it and talk to us, you know. We need to hear from you. We need to hear from you because we're apparently going insane.
Yes. Yeah, if you comment on Facebook, we'll see it, we'll respond, we'll have a conversation. You can send your comments in to the email address. You can send a laugh track of your own into the email address, howtomedieval@gmail.com. It's T-W-O for two, howtomedieval@gmail.com. And we'll play it on the show.
Yeah, and I promise next we'll start getting back into some more serious tips and tricks and guidance talks.
Yes. You have learned, we have a tip and a trick today. We have learned that it is important to still have fun.
Exactly. It is important to still have fun. Thanks for listening.
Bye.